Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Hey, good morning to you, 908 on KDXU. I'm Andy. I'm back in studio. For those of you that paid close attention, even though we ran a show yesterday, it was an old show. It was a recording. We call them best of in the business. I was not here. And then Tuesday, I believe they ran. I don't know. I was so sick, I didn't really even care. I believe they ran a satellite program. Mello is over there. Hi, Mello. You doing okay? Oh, you know what? You have to use the other microphone. For whatever reason, that microphone is burned out. So, yeah, grab that other microphone. Pull it closer. You got it? He's reaching for the microphone. All right, we'll get that other microphone going later. Dr. Blodgett is with me today. Dr. David Blodgett from the Southwest Utah Public Health Department. Hi, Dr. Blodgett. He was supposed to be here Wednesday. That's the day I was, under the weather, let's put it that way. And Dr. Blodgett thankfully agreed to come say hi to us today.
That's great to be here. A chance to talk through important things, I guess.
Yeah, I appreciate you coming in. Gosh, a lot to talk about today. I know you have some calendar things that we want to bring up. I thought it would be, a week ago, talked with Dave Heaton, who works for you, about earthquake preparedness, about emergency preparedness, really. The focus was on earthquake preparedness, but I thought it would be appropriate for us to spend a little bit of time and talk about, I wanted to get nuts and bolts, the actual numbers we need, maybe not numbers, but the actual things we need in case a big emergency were to strike. You know, a lot of us grew up, especially if you're a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, grew up, emergency preparedness, what do they call it? The food storage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We had the ubiquitous barrels of rice or barrels of wheat or whatever. And, I think after a while we started to go, well, do I really want to eat nothing but wheat for when the apocalypse comes? And so we've kind of adjusted those a little bit, but, what would you say? Is there a minimum amount of stuff we need? Is it, a 24-hour kit, 90-hour kit, 90-day kit? What do you think?
Well, so how to say this? I think more is better sometimes, but I think sometimes just starting is the way to go, right?
So, do you mind if we prop that mic up a little bit so we can hear you better?
So yeah, okay, there sorry. So let me tell you a story. So,
oh, I love stories. Yeah.
So right before 9/11 and happened. Mm-hmm. They did a study where they asked Americans, "How many of you have a 72-hour kit so you could be self-sustaining for 72 hours if something bad were to happen?"
I'm guessing we didn't do very well.
Right. So the national recommendation they always talk about is have a 72-hour kit. Right. Make sure you can be independent for 72 hours and things like that. And so. So they asked the question, and about 11% of Americans said that they could do
11%? That's terrible.
Yeah, well, that's so the story keeps going, right? So 9/11 happens, and we think, we've talked all about being prepared and kits, and, really focused on 72-hour kits so everybody can be ready for 72 hours. Then they went back out 2 years later. Okay. And ask them, okay, now how many people?
So we had the sobering 9/11 happen, the weird flights were shut down for a time, and everything. We learned our lesson, right?
We had the anthrax attack, everything happened.
We all got ready, right? Yeah. How did we do?
So we came back and 11%.
11!
No
difference?
No difference.
Oh, my.
In fact, it probably went down a little bit. They still do that survey, and it's always stayed about 11%. So when you ask me, how much should we get? That's a good question, but I want to. Sometimes I have to stay on the. Well, let's just talk about the basics, right? So get that 72-hour kit put together. We have resources on our website that can help you put it together. Some things to think about, things to have in there that are available to you, even if it's just when you think about, wow, how am I going to make sure I have medications for 3 days? And you know, just even some basic things like that. Shoes are always a big problem. They say when people grab stuff and head out of their house, sometimes they won't have shoes on. And then imagine trying to navigate a situation where there's an emergency without shoes. And it's very difficult to bring shoes in because shoes are individual, right? And so there's a lot of things in that arena that are really important to consider, but about 11% of us have. So, 11%.
Now, and I think it's worth mentioning, you say, well, something big will never happen. It's never going to happen to us. But think about Lahaina, Hawaii.
Yeah.
Okay, here's a town, a resort town in the middle of a paradise, really. Beautiful place. They never thought anything like what happened in Lahaina, where basically the whole town burned to the ground. They never thought anything like that would happen.
Right. So you mentioned an earthquake. We actually are on an earthquake. The hurricane fault.
The hurricane runs fault.
Right through us. And when we get together for a big preparedness effort with the emergency managers from the county and the health department and everybody gets together, we go do a training. Sometimes we go back east to do that. We did about 10 years ago. Guess what the topic was?
Earthquakes.
Earthquake. Yeah. Right. And so I think it's likely that we'll have an earthquake at some point that's significant enough to really cause disruption of food and water and all of those things that you think about. And so we plan for many things. We live in a complicated society and everything demands our attention. But this is something to add to the list of, you know, what would I do if I couldn't make it into my home, or if I had to leave my home for a little while.
Well, and that's even, you know, you can go kind of micro scale. Say your house burned down. I have a friend, well, they're my wife's friends, my wife's coworker, their house burned down.
Yeah.
It happened in the middle of the night. They had to get up, run out of their house so they wouldn't die. Well, when you get up at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning and have to run out of your house, you don't really take a whole lot with you, right? I mean, you're worried about being alive.
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
Even though the house didn't burn all the way to the ground, it was condemned enough they weren't allowed to go back inside. And inside were their PCs, their medicines, their obviously their food, their clothing. It was all in there. Even though a lot of it wasn't necessarily ruined, they couldn't get to it. They weren't allowed to go back in the house. I mean, absolutely. Talk about emergency preparedness.
Yeah, absolutely. And so then you have nothing.
Right? You have to start over.
You're facing life all over again. And, you know, eventually they probably had a chance to get some of that stuff out.
Yeah.
But I bet it took weeks.
It did.
Right?
Yeah,
so,
it did.
What's the saying? When the time for action has come, the time for preparing has passed.
Yeah, you missed it.
And so
I just think that we don't. You know, and the problem is it's out there. When you said it's likely we're going to have an earthquake, well, somebody says, okay, Dr. Blodgett, when?
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. You know, nobody it could knows. Be tomorrow. It could be in 2025. It could be in 2055. We don't know. It's same with a house fire or a wildfire, any kind of disaster. We don't know. That's what makes it so hard to prepare for, because we don't know. We don't think it ever actually will, I think.
Right. Well, and, you know, it's like keeping insurance. Well, I haven't ever used it before, so why should I have it now? That's just not the purpose, right? The purpose is if it does happen, then you're ready. So
just in case it does, it does happen. I was saying that you can almost apply the same logic to our health. You know, if someone is, man, I was reading a thing, 42% of adult males are obese in the United States of America.
That is true.
42%. I was like, wait a minute. That means that all the warnings that Dr. Blodgett and his friends give us about heart disease, about, you know, diabetes, about high blood pressure, hypertension, all these warnings are largely going unheeded because, well, I mean, you know, we're not listening, apparently. Same kind of thing. Well, heart disease will never happen to me.
Yeah, well, and the number's even bigger when you ask overweight. So overweight and obese. So obese is, you know, 30% overweight, but overweight is, you know, above where you should be, and that's probably 65 or 66%
of men,
and probably 60% overall of the population. So we, I had this dreadful epiphany the other day.
I don't like bad epiphany. I like good epiphanies.
I was, you know, I was out. Some groups have asked me to come and speak about sleep. You know, it's been kind of my topic, and I was out speaking about sleep, and I had people afterwards come and talking to me, and they said, "Well, you know, I've really tried everything to sleep better, and I just can't get good sleep, you know, and you need to give me better advice." And I asked them.
They blamed you.
So I said, "Well, let's go through a couple of things we talked about. Have you stopped looking at your phone right before you go to bed?" And that's too hard, right? So in their mind, and I think we do this with eating, with everything else. In our minds, we say, "Well, you know, I really want to do this because I want to be healthier or sleep better or whatever it is." But no, don't ask me to do that part of it, right?
Yeah, that doesn't count.
I hate it when the answer is exercise, and don't ask me to walk for 30 minutes a day because I'm just not going to do that. And so it was an interesting realization that even when people, I think, have good intentions, it's not the good intentions that get you there. It's the actual, you know, buckling down and saying, you know what, I feel strongly about this, that I'm going to do something about it. So,
what's the old saying? The road to hell is paved with good intentions.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's kind of the road to good health is paved with good intentions, or actually the road to bad health is paved with good intentions of things we mean to do or want to do but don't.
Yeah, and I really think that being moderate about this is a way to start to think about it. Being, you know, instead of buying into the idea that, well, if I don't run marathons, then I'm never going to be healthy, it's just not true, right? It's the little things, and moving down that continuum of the little things, I think, is the way to approach this. Little bite-sized pieces, not trying to, you know, eat the whole elephant all at the same time. And I hope we've been fairly consistent in our messaging that way. I think we've, you know, tried to get people moving that way, but the world is complicated, and
it is. Yeah.
And we all have competing things for our attention, and you know, people always ask me, well, you know, what kind of exercise is the best, or what, you know, what's one food is the best? I'm like, we're not there, right? Where we are is, if we could get people to add a day of an hour of exercise a week, and then two, and then, you know, get into that 150 minutes a week that we, you know, is kind of the sweet spot. If we can add an extra fruit or vegetable, you know, at least a few times a week, and then maybe, you know, every day get up to a little bit more there. I mean, that's where I think changes start to happen in people's lives that they notice. And then you start talking about sleep, maybe take it seriously and start to look at how you approach sleep. And I had a good moment the other day where I realized, you know, I've managed in my own life to not be casual about bedtime. I've ingrained
it
enough
seriously.
that what if, you know, if it gets to be 11 o'clock, then I know I'm past where I should be. And that's a change for me, but that took some time. Right. So I think that's how these positive behaviors happen in our lives, is intentional, a little bit of intentional focus that gets us to where we want to be.
I agree. In fact, I was casual about bedtime most of my life until you started coming on the show and talking about, you know, setting a good bedtime and getting to sleep and getting enough sleep. And honestly, I, you know, for me, I'd have 4 hours one night and 8 or 9 the next, and just it was back and forth and all around. And in the last few years, I've set a sleep goal, 7 hours. Maybe that's not enough. Maybe it should be 8, but 7 hours. And I know for me, I get up crazy early time. There's a certain time of night. This is go time. You've got to get to bed.
It's drop dead. And I think you have to honor that in your mind in order for it to work. And then
it needs to be real.
A lot of these other suggestions we make help. But until you are willing to say, I'm really serious about this, this is what I want for myself, I just don't think it ever happens. I mean, you know, we tend to get what we really desire.
That's true. Speaking of sleep, this weekend is daylight savings time.
Yes.
Which means, let's see, spring forward, so we're going to set our clocks forward, which means we're losing an hour.
Losing an hour, yeah. So, you know, there's a national debate going on about daylight savings time.
Mm-hmm.
Congress, National Congress, you know, D.C. actually passed a resolution saying that we should fix the time on daylight savings time and just not bounce back and forth. But right. then didn't happen because there has to be some other things that happen and, you know, it has to be cleaned up. But we're getting there. The statistics are fairly alarming, right? You just that 1 hour change in sleep makes a big difference. Accidents go up by 15%. Heart attacks go up by 15%, you know, with that hour change. And then they improve by 15%, you know, when we do the other way. So it's an area to look at as a societal prospect of, you know, how do our policies impact that. And yeah, there's a lot of areas where our policies really are counterproductive to sleep. You look at schools mm-hmm. and school start times and things like that. I mean, there's just a lot of areas where I think there's more discussion starting, and we'll see if there's ways to help people get better sleep. But
I actually wrote an article last month about kids sleeping in and how test results showed over and over again that if they started school, say, at 9 or 9:30 instead of 7:30 or 8, that test results go up. Kids are more – it's good for them.
There's whole schools that have done that. They've started – they've moved to a later start time. Their ACT scores or their SAT scores go up. Their overall GPA, the discipline problems in the school go down. The rates of substance abuse and all those things go down. And so it's remarkable. It's one of those areas that you kind of look at and you say, why haven't I paid more attention to this in my life? You know, but
Do you have an opinion, by the way, on daylight savings time? There is actually a school of thought that said we should go on daylight savings and leave it there as opposed to no daylight savings at all or the bouncing back and forth. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I think as long as we pick one and stick with it, I think that's what will be best. I think probably just good old regular time is probably fine. The problem with that is then you end up with times where it's really dark by the time you get out of work. And
yeah, you
can't
get off of work at 5:15 and it's dark.
And so that was part of the reason that daylight savings time was implemented, was to try and help there be at least a little bit of light and dark for at least most of the year before and after work. But I think the data suggests that the regular time is probably that is the time that fits best with the normal rhythms of life and stuff like that.
Quit fooling with them. Arizona does not change. Arizona stays on. I think it's just regular time. They don't do daylight saving at all.
They do.
And it seems to work for them. Yeah. It's kind of weird because half the year we're the same time as them. Half of the year they're on Pacific.
Right, and they give up a lot of federal transportation dollars.
Really?
That. Yeah, they tie some federal dollars
to it. Cost them money.
And,
huh?
So they're willing to take that. But my wife actually has family in Arizona, and they say, well, we have plenty of sunshine. We don't need more.
That's so true. Especially in July and August. They have way too much sunshine.
So when it's staying light till 11 o'clock or something at night, you know, 10:30, it doesn't help them much. So
Again, we're about to do a weather break here. I did want to reiterate the emergency preparedness stuff. Dr. Blodgett doesn't say have X amount of whatever. Just try to do better than you're doing, I think, is really the goal.
Well, at least feel like you have something ready so if something bad happens in your life. And, you know, there's lots of areas of preparedness that help, like getting out of debt, like we've all been counseled from Benjamin Franklin's time, right? And how does the saying go? You should have, you know, an emergency fund and not an emergency stash of debt. So
you sound like my wife now.
I just I think there's these areas where you can be cognizant of the fact that, man, if you're living life on the edge, that doesn't leave a lot of room for something to go wrong. But life is all about something going wrong, and we want to blame somebody else for it. But, you know, it's kind of the way life works. So
a few years ago, I lost my job. And fortunately, my wife has a good job, and we were fine. But it did test, you know, we had to live on a much, much tighter budget.
Right.
And, you know, and some of the luxuries that we wanted or liked we couldn't do those anymore. And, you know, it's a reality. And in any business, I have a friend who just barely had their job eliminated. A new corporation bought their company, and they're like, okay, see ya. You know, and I have no idea what they were making, but I'm guessing somewhere in the $70,000 to $80,000 a year range, and it's just gone now.
Yeah, not even there. I, you know, since you mentioned businesses, having a preparedness plan for business or whatever you do is important. The statistics is that if your business closes for 2 weeks, 86% will not reopen.
Mm.
And so, how do you have a plan to quickly get back in the saddle and reopen, or else have some sort of a reserve that you can weather a little bit of a storm, you know? Maybe your water line breaks and your store is flooded or something like that.
I think about that smoothie store, Tropical Smoothie, just over here on Red Hills Parkway. A guy ran into their wall, and they're closed now. And I don't know that they'll ever reopen because, like you said, who can afford to not be bringing money in for been a month now, I think.
You see it quite frequently, and it's just part of this idea of, man, let's just think through the logistics of what happens if things don't go exactly as I planned. Is there a way to kind of buffer that in some way? And so we have lots of resources on our website. There's lots of links out there to other places that can help you plan. There's actually business planning guides and 72-hour kit planning guide. All of those things are available to you, and I hope you maybe this is a good opportunity to talk about that.
So. SWUhealth.org is the website, and if there's just one of the links is emergency preparedness, and there's all kinds of resources there, including Medical Reserve Corps, Healthcare Coalition, FEMA, and just a lot of great links on that website. Making sure you're ready for the rainy day, maybe because of rain, it may be because of fire or whatever, the rainy day might come. All right, Dr. Blodgett is with me. We're going to take a quick break, weather break. When we come back, we'll talk about, daylight savings again. Also, it is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month. Have you had a colonoscopy? I know nobody wants to talk about it, but it's real.
All the latest news, weather, traffic, and sports, just like you like them. You're waking up with the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU. Southern Utah's News Talk Leader.
Welcome back. I think Mello is with us now. Mello, are you there? No, still nothing. All right. Darn it. All right. We'll see if we can get Mello figured out here in a minute. But Dr. Blodgett is here. I'm Andy. Thanks for tuning into the program. Normally open lines on Friday, but because of my illness, Dr. Blodgett had to miss Wednesday, so it's good to have him here today. Colorectal Cancer Awareness, Dr. Blodgett. You know, all growing up, I heard, you got to get a colonoscopy when you're 50. And I was like, I don't want to hear about it. And of course, when I was 50, I got a colonoscopy and found out that the colonoscopy part of it is nothing. They put you to sleep anyway.
Right.
It was the stuff leading up to the colonoscopy.
That's the problem, right?
So. That was brutal. And I experienced it again the last couple of days because even though I wasn't getting a colonoscopy, I got really, really, like you said, gastrointestinal problems the last couple of days. But what's the standard right now on colonoscopies? When should we have them and how often?
Well, you know what's interesting is we're finding that colorectal cancer is creeping younger.
Really?
Yeah. So the recommendation was always to get colorectal cancer screening starting when you were 50. Mm-hmm. But just recently, within the last 2 years, they bumped that up to 45.
45. Have they figured out why, or do they have some theories as to why it's creeping younger?
Well, there's always theories, right?
Yeah, like all the packaged, prepackaged foods we eat.
Yeah, probably that. Probably we're less active than we've ever been. Less, you know, or as we get larger, we talked about the, you know, obesity. Then obesity is tied to cancers, and particularly colorectal cancers. So probably something in that arena too. Might just so here's something I wonder about. Part of the reason that you digest food as quickly as you can, move it through the system, sometimes at the expense of getting all the energy out of the food, is that you want it there is not, if there's a carcinogen there, you want to move it through,
yeah.
Right? And okay. So that's why things like a high fiber diet really helps with colorectal cancer, is you actually move things through your your bowels more quickly. So what happens if you deliberately slow that down?
Sounds familiar, like a certain couple of quote-unquote miracle drugs out
there.
Yeah, right now.
So I don't know what that means, but we don't have the long-term data.
The jury's, you
know,
still
but
out.
It's, yeah. But it would be interesting to, just in the context of colorectal cancer and what we know about how to prevent that. I did see they toy with the idea of, you know, that aspirin is the wonder drug in a lot of things, and they toy with the idea, does it help or not help with colorectal cancer? There was another study that came out recently saying it might help. So that's something to watch as to whether or not those, you know, that daily baby aspirin can help with certain people with their risk for heart attacks.
Right.
Maybe now colorectal cancer. Who knows?
My dad swears by the baby aspirin.
Yeah,
he takes one every day.
There's some people that it's definitely recommended for when you talk to your doctor. Others, it's just not. There's you have to balance it with the risk for intestinal bleeding and stuff, mm-hmm. right? So there's a trade-off there.
Yeah, it is kind of harsh on the GI.
And so so it's not universally recommended, but it is for a pretty good chunk of people. So I don't know, something to consider. So the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, they're the one that make recommendations for colorectal cancer screening. And an A is definitely strongly recommended, strong evidence. B is recommended, the evidence is not quite as strong. C is no. Or talk about it with your doctor.
Right.
So for those 45 to 49, that's a B recommendation.
Okay.
50 to 75, A. But interestingly, above 75, C.
Yeah.
So the thing is, for most people, you know, that once you get past your 70s, 80s, whatever, maybe that would be helpful for you. It kind of depends on your overall health status and stuff like that. And then above 85... No recommendation there. So
it's a sad truth, but it is true. After you get to be a certain age, if you get, say, prostate or colon cancer, that's probably not even necessarily what's going to kill you if you're already 90 years old.
Yeah, if you biopsy 190 year olds you biopsy their prostate, you'll find 190-year-olds with prostate cancer, mm-hmm. right? So it just depends on everything. It's in context of your age and everything else. So
interesting. 45, though, is the new recommendation for getting that screen.
45 is the new recommendation to start. So there's multiple options you can use. We've talked about that in the past. It's not just colonoscopy, but you can use there's tests that can test for blood in your stool. That's very good. You can have, there's more and more virtual options coming on that are available. So colonoscopy has kind of been the gold standard, but it's not the only standard, and might not even be, you know, the best way to do it for a lot of people. If you don't mind getting a card and you putting a I mean, this, I don't know why I get to talk about this stuff, but you just put a little of your own poo on there, and it'll tell you whether there's blood in there. You do that once a year. Maybe that's easier than, you know, going in for a colonoscopy, so you don't have to be afraid of it. So.
You know, health screening is interesting. I've had this theory, and I may be way off base, and that's why Dr. Blodgett is here, because he knows the answer to most of these things, that we have the technology right now, incredibly expensive technology, but we have the technology right now. We could detect almost any kind of problem in the body right now through some of our electronic and magnetic tests. Is that true? They're just really expensive, and so the general population can't afford them?
Well, no. Here's the problem.
Okay.
And maybe there is a cost consideration, but there is another consideration, and that is every screening has a cost associated with it. That's different than what we're talking about, money.
Okay. The cost is not financial.
So let's just say you do an MRI on everybody in America, and you find 1% of the population has a spot on their liver.
Okay.
What does that mean?
Could be cancer.
Could be.
Could be.
Yeah, but it could be nothing, right? Because probably 1% of Americans have a spot on their liver anyway.
Yeah.
So, but what do you do with that? Well, now you know there's something there, right? So now you got to go in, you got to biopsy it, you got to surgeries, you got the risk of anesthesia, you've got surgical risk.
Infection,
There's a ton of money associated with it. And so the question is, have you prevented much by doing that? And the answer is no.
Not really.
No, you haven't. And so most of the time, screenings only work in the correct context in which they're given. So that's why you have this U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which gives recommendations on which tests to use and not use. They look at all the data of the benefits versus the harms and all of that stuff, and it comes down to, and there's some things that we do pretty regularly that are just, the evidence is they don't help much. One of them is prostate cancer screening. It's a do it with your doctor kind of suggestion, but for most people, you're far more likely to cause a lot more harm by screening for prostate cancer than you are by not doing it.
Interesting.
And that has to do with the fact that most prostate cancers are, or even abnormalities in the prostate, are benign. They don't kill you, but the treatment you get might. So we don't have the perfect technologies for screenings that will tell you if you have something bad, but not something that's not bad or that doesn't lead you to more problems. So the classic example of this was AAAs, aortic aneurysms.
Okay.
So that's a swelling of the aorta that can burst, right? And so the idea is, wow, if you can find that, because it's almost always fatal. I don't know.
That'll
if
kill you. Yeah.
Yeah, John Ritter died from that kind of thing. But here's the problem. Probably about 7 or 8% of Americans have a little bit of dilation of the aorta, and it's never going to cause them a problem.
That's, what, more than half a million or something?
So you screen all those people. You now know all these people have a dilation in their aorta, and you put them through surgery to deal with that, right? Well, the risk from surgery on the aorta, because it's a very, it's the main artery coming out
of
your heart,
is
like 11% fatality rate, right? And so now you've got all these people that probably would have been just fine that you've now killed because you put them through the process.
The risk to fix it was greater than the risk to live, possibly, maybe have it.
So these options where you go in and you get some sort of universal screening looking for anything wrong in your body without some sort of clinical context to it are actually probably more harmful than good when you really look at the science behind it.
I guess in a perfect world where we had the perfect treatment for everything, then that would be a good thing.
If you had the perfect treatment and the perfect screening, right?
Yeah.
So the screening could tell you with certainty what it was you were looking at every time, but we just don't have that. Every test has it's a bell-shaped curve. It identifies some people that have the disease and some people that don't. It's part of the intricacies of the science that are fascinating and interesting to deal with sometimes.
That kind of bleeds into a little bit this whole genome testing, the genetic testing, where you know, and it's, there's some right here in St. George. It's a program right here in St. George where they're able to tell you you have a certain percent chance to get this certain disease in your lifetime based on your genetics. It kind of bleeds into that a little bit because, you know, at what point do you go, you know, I have a, you know, I have a 12% chance of getting heart disease. And yeah, you can do, like you say, you can do the little things to try to prevent that, but who's going to do that? A lot of people just won't. Or then you can take drastic measures, but sometimes, as you said, the drastic measures are worse. The cure is worse than the disease.
Yeah, can I tell you the ultimate example of that?
Sure.
So there's a disease called Huntington's disease.
Huntington's, yes.
It's a terrible disease. It's autosomal dominant. So
and we talked about it maybe 3 years ago, so this is a good review. Yep.
So most people families that have it, if somebody in the family has it, then half of the children will get it. Right.
That's a pretty high number.
And if you have it, it's fatal, right?
Yeah.
It's a terrible disease. But it doesn't start until you hit 35, 40 years old until later on in life. And so you can grow, you can, you know, go get married, have children, and you don't know whether you have it until later, right?
So you got married at 25, you had 4 kids. Unbeknownst to you, you had this whatever, right. You were carrying this genetic disease, and half of your 4 kids are probably going
to
get it.
Yeah, and then you pass it on to your children. Yeah. Mm. So in the world of genetic testing, you would think that should be kind of a no-brainer, right? Get tested, then you know, and then you can make decisions based on that.
Yeah.
But do you really want to know?
Do you want to know?
Right? Mm. And so what happens in real life when they study these families is about 40% get tested. The rest don't. And, I don't know. Do you really want to know what your history is, and do you want other people to know? So there's privacy issues here that I think are kind of troubling as well, right? What happens if you take that genetic screening and it shows you've got a higher than normal risk of heart disease, for example? Do you want that to get out to your employer?
Mm-hmm.
Or to your life insurance company or something like that, you know?
Yeah. If you're going to get married, you might have Huntington's in your future, do you want you got to tell your spouse, I guess, your future spouse, hey, just so you know, there's going to be a 50% chance that I'm going to pass this on to our kids. I mean, talk about it.
So there are subtleties here that are not as easy as the advertising, right?
Yeah.
And I guess that's the case in all things in life. And sometimes our technology gets ahead of our ability to kind of think through the issues, right? And say, wow, wait a second, you know, is this something I really personally in my life want to know, you know?
Yeah.
And,
wow. I watched a stupid movie the other night, and I'm not going to say the name of it because I don't think it's worth anybody else watching it. But one of the things about the movie was one of the guys could reveal through some kind of technology with high probability the date and the way that you're going to pass away. And, you know, he was going around telling people, and a lot of people were like, I don't want to know.
Exactly.
You know, and that actually presents, it's that age old. If you knew what day and how you were going to die, would you want to know that? A lot of people don't want to know that. Yeah. You know, if I knew I was going to die from heart disease at the age of 59, which is next year, I don't want to know that.
Yeah. I.
Mello says she does want to know.
Or does that give you a license to be a little bad before you're...
Yeah.
Good,
no,
right?
I don't know. You know, deathbed repentance. And I don't know. Do you rack up the debt and rack up the credit card knowing you're not going to... You know, there's a truth out there, and my wife has found this out through her job, but if someone has a credit card that is only in their name and they die, that debt goes away.
Right.
I hate to bring that up, but, you know, don't get a joint credit card if one of you has bad health, because
you're going to die sometime soon.
I hate to say that, but it's true. One more commercial break, more with Dr. Blodgett after this.
Wake up with the news and information you can trust. This is the Andy Griffin Show on News Radio 890, 92.5 KDXU, Southern Utah's News Talk leader.
I'm Andy. Thanks for tuning in today. Just got over the stomach flu, and I got to tell you, folks, it's not fun. You've ever had a colonoscopy and had to drink that stuff before the colonoscopy, that's kind of what happened to me, only I wasn't getting a colonoscopy. And I'm going to stay away from being gross. Just suffices to say, I had to be within about 20 steps of a bathroom at all times over the last 2 days, and not counting today, but over, you know, on Wednesday and Thursday. So I'm glad to be back and feel much better.
Glad you're feeling
better. Yes. Yes, it is. It's not fun. Okay. What were we going to talk about on your list?
We have one last thing. Our health magazine.
Oh yeah, yeah. New magazine coming out
in a week or so to watch for. So this will be actually a 25th celebration edition. It's our 25th issue of Health. Wow, since nice. We went to calling it the Health magazine.
This is monthly or is this bi-monthly? Or?
We put it out every three times a year.
Okay.
So every 4 months.
Yeah.
It's just our staff, and that's plenty of work for us to get that done.
Oh yeah,
it's a lot of work to put a magazine together. But
for sure,
from the standpoint of
I've done that
of the ability to put out messages that are really important and get them to every person in the district, there's nothing that tops it. So
I gotta ask you,
cost effective and all that stuff.
I'm a lifelong writer. I like to write. I've it's almost therapy for me to write a really do you like to write? As a doctor, you know, I mean, you studied and you had to write plenty, I'm sure, in college and stuff, but writing for a magazine is a little bit different. Yeah. Do you like that process? Is it enjoyable for you?
I don't mind it. I actually quite enjoy it's a break from the other rigmarole that I do. I like speaking sometimes too. We were coming off the session, right? And so I spent a ton of time trying to figure out how to navigate through the process of the legislature, and to be able to take some time and collect your thoughts and write something is nice. It is. It's good.
Well, again, Health Magazine coming out about a week from now?
Yeah, probably 2 weeks. It should hit your mailbox. Just watch for it. And some of the articles in this issue are going to be best of throughout the 25 issues because it's a 25 celebration. But then there are a few new articles in there. My article this time is about alcohol and the risk of alcohol abuse and the toll it takes on our society. So,
Dr. Blodgett told me a fact during one of the commercial breaks about drunk or being drunk. You want to repeat that fact? It's a weird but interesting but
weird
true
statistic,
fact.
Yeah. So are you more likely to die drunk walking or drunk driving?
Yeah. Well, you would think drunk walking is very uncommon, so you would think that you must be driving.
Yeah, but being drunk and walking as a pedestrian makes you more likely to die than drunk driving.
Wow.
Even though drunk driving has other consequences, right? So certainly something never want to do, but there are consequences for both there. So
do not drink and, well, just call a cab.
Yeah.
Call a cab.
Being a pedestrian, you can imagine stumbling and ending up in the road, right before somebody's there. It happens. So that was not an intuitive finding, but that was something I saw the other day.
I would, again, recommend everybody go to swuhealth.org. So many great resources there. There's a whole section on injury prevention and just a personal little tip. What part of that is motorcycle awareness. I'm a lifelong motorcycle guy. I have not ridden the last few years since I had an accident and my balance is really off. But, just be aware that there are people out there who, I mean, you talk about, drunk walking versus drunk driving. How about being on a motorcycle and going 50 or 60 miles an hour and someone pulls in front of you?
Right. Absolutely.
And I wasn't going that fast when someone pulled in front of me, but I was going, fast enough that it was pretty... I'm still feeling the effects of it, and it happened 7 years ago.
It's they're say, the roads here too have gotten more crowded. I think everybody knows that, and as the infrastructure is strained, and we start putting people on the roads that weren't meant to be there, all of that becomes safety needs to be a consideration for everybody.
What's the helmet law right now in Utah? If you're an adult, 18 and older, you're not required by law to wear a helmet. Is that true?
I think that legislation passed within the last few years. So, yeah.
If you're under 18, you are required to wear a helmet.
Right. But, that only makes sense to wear a helmet.
I just, yeah, brain bucket, as they call it in the business. But my wife calls motorcycles donor cycles. I'm never going to condemn motorcycles. I feel like people have the right to ride them, and I feel like there's a certain amount of freedom when you're on a motorcycle that you don't get anywhere else. But that being said, even if you have a helmet on, imagine the effect on the body if you go down going any amount of speed at all.
Yeah. Well, you look at the forces involved, you know, when you've got momentum going one way and another way coming at the same time, that multiplies the forces. And so, you know, the engineering on cars has gotten so much better over the years that you're much less likely to die than you used to be in a car accident. But even then, it's bad. But when there's no protection between you and whatever's there, that can be difficult.
We're out of time. He's Dr. Blodgett, Southwest Utah Public Health Department, SWUhealth.org. Thank you, Doc.
Hey, thanks for having me.
We'll see you Monday.